Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 12th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. My voice is, believe it or not, on the mend. Joining us, Benjamin Dixon from the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also, David Roth, former Deadspin writer, now writing everywhere, including the New Republic. Also on the program, Donald Trump calls for compassionate force in policing. Gonna kill them with love. New polling, most Americans, including Republicans, support the Democratic police reform proposals. Doesn't mean they go far enough. Meanwhile, cops showing regret for joining protesters and taking a knee, and the military showing regret for being used by Trump. Oregon pauses their reopening as nearly a dozen states hit their highest levels of new cases of coronavirus. Trump plans rallies with limited liability for his supporters and to disrespect the memory of multiple racial carnages. Steve Mnuchin says the PPP loans are now secret, and Congress is dropping its own ball in its failure to provide any oversight for the rest of the bailouts. Meanwhile, the country is on the precipice of mass evictions, particularly in black, brown, and low-income communities. Elizabeth Warren's amendment forces a Republican Senate committee to vote to change Confederate names on military bases. Joe Biden balks at the Bloomberg Digital Agency. And Donald Trump sanctions the International War Crimes Court because it had the audacity of investigating Afghan war crimes. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Please forgive me. My voice is obviously, as you can tell, not at its peak performance, but even at, I think it's probably around, what would you say, Brendan, Matt, you guys listen to me almost every day, drone on and on. Would you say the voice is at like 40% or 60%?
I would say 60, because you're not, it doesn't seem like you need to cough a lot, or, you know, it just seems depressed a little bit.
Right. It's depressed. Believe me, all of it's depressed.
You're not dropping words.
Right.
Or sounds.
Even at 60%, ladies and gentlemen, I am still hovering around like 130% of your average political podcast, live podcast host, I would say, right?
Yeah, your above replacement is about a six. So, you know, you're
I don't know what that means, but the voice is
depressed. I miss baseball.
The voice is depressed. And And this, of course, is a function. I've been told that this happens to me every year around this time. Maybe it's allergies. I contend it's just yelling at my children. But who knows? Meanwhile, let's get to this. This is Donald Trump has now planned a rally for, I guess it's a week from today, Juneteenth, June 19th, which is a day that commemorates, I don't know if commemorates is the right word, but stands in recognition of the slavery and its abolition and the problems of race and that black people have dealt with since the founding of this country. Tulsa, Oklahoma, of course, this year we're recognizing. It's been 99 years, the Tulsa massacre. And so at the very least, it's incredibly insensitive. It's a function of maybe no one around there in that operation being aware of things. At its worst, it is a redux of Ronald Reagan in 79, launching his campaign for the presidency in Philadelphia, Mississippi, in Neshoba County, literally just miles away, in the Neshoba County Fair, I think it was, miles away from where three civil rights activists were murdered by the KKK. And that murder also was, you know, the subtext of that was the idea that, like, you Northerners, you federal government cannot come here and tell us how to treat our black people. And when Ronald Reagan made his announcement, his presidential kickoff in that, at that county fair, the theme of his speech was states' rights, which now, but even more dramatically so when you're talking about, you know, less than 20 years out, I mean, 15 years. I mean, you know, it's amazing for me to contemplate this because when I remember 1980, I was my daughter's age. And the idea of 1965 felt like a lifetime ago, but the idea of 15 years ago to be there, 15 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, to be there less than two decades from when those battles happened, and to announce that is just, it becomes even more stunning to me as I'm older and I realize how little amount of time 15 years is.
Sam, I'm looking at this Neshoba speech Wikipedia, and I think the context actually was, this was the first speech after he had been declared the nominee for the GOP. This was August 3rd, 1980.
It was as he launched his general election campaign.
Yeah.
So 1980 as opposed to 79. And nevertheless, same point. He's there basically proclaiming states' rights. I find it hard to believe that there aren't Republicans in the White House who are not conscious of this dynamic. I find it very hard to believe it. He's also announced that they are doing the RNC in Jacksonville. And I don't know if he's giving his speech on the day or they're just starting it on the same day that apparently, I guess it was 60 years ago, was it? The axe handle, brutality that took place there.
Axe handle Saturday.
The axe handle Saturday. And, you know, who knows? But I would imagine someone in Jacksonville knows this. We haven't booked anything for Axe Handle Saturday. Why don't you bring the convention then? But So that's the backdrop of everything. We'll talk more about that with Ben Dixon. But here is Donald Trump being asked. Now, with this backdrop, understand. He's given a speech in Tulsa, Oklahoma on Friday. He is on Juneteenth. And the Jacksonville, you know, he's giving a speech in Jacksonville on Axe Handle Saturday. Here he is being asked, why did you reference looting and shooting from 1968? He's on Fox, Fox News, one of the outnumbered folks. Here he is being asked about that, why he used that particular phrase.
Sound.
You know, there are two more things I want to talk with you about, and you look at me, and I'm Paris on TV, but I'm a black woman. Yeah. I'm a mom. And, you know, when, and you've talked about it, but we haven't seen you come out and be that consoler in this instance. And the tweets, yeah. When the looting starts, the shooting starts. Why those words?
So that's an expression I've heard over the years. And it
do you know
really
where it comes from?
To, I think Philadelphia, the mayor of Philadelphia.
No,
from what
it comes from 1967. I was about 18 months old at the time. Everybody's shooting Wiki because they probably got it wrong. But it was from the chief of police in Miami. He was cracking down, and he meant what he said. And he said, I don't even care if it makes it look like brutality. I'm going to crack down when the looting starts, the shooting starts.
Yeah.
That frightened a lot of people when you tweeted
that. Well,
it
also comes from a very tough mayor who I might have been police commissioner at the time, but I think mayor of Philadelphia named Frank Rizzo. And he had an expression like that. But I've heard it many times from, I think it's been used many times. It means two things, very different things. One is if there's looting, there's probably going to be shooting. And that's not as a threat. That's really just a fact, because that's what happens. And the other is if there's looting, there's going to be shooting. They're very different meanings.
Oh, interesting.
No, there's very different meanings. But I think
Do you think most people see it that way?
I think they see it both ways. No, I mean, I've had it viewed both ways. I think it's meant both ways, not by the same person. But when the looting starts, it oftentimes means there's going to be shooting, there's going to be death, there's going to be killing, and it's a bad thing. And it's also used as a threat. It's used both ways. But if you think about it, look at what happened, how people were devastated with the looting. Look at what happened.
So just to be clear, I don't know much about that Miami police chief. I know that Wallace used it in the following year or years after the Miami police chief. But I do know that Frank Rizzo's statue was taken down literally like 4 days ago in Philadelphia, because he was renowned for abusing people's rights, for police brutality, for coercion, for intimidating people, for brutalizing them, particularly black people. And so to basically, it's like, oh no, I wasn't quoting the Nazis. I was quoting the KKK is basically what his defense is.
This and is from New York Times on this Rizzo statue getting taken down. Says most of his supporters, overwhelmingly white, have also died, and his confrontational style as police commissioner and mayor is viewed as a relic of another time when he could appeal to racial resentment while trying to run for a third term as mayor by urging supporters to, quote, vote white. So.
Yeah, okay. So, but I didn't mean it. I meant it in the verb intransitive. I didn't mean that it was a consequence. I said that shooting correlates with looting, not that it's a consequence. So I can't. Twitter is just too confining for me. I can't express the nuance of what I was suggesting. One of the reasons why you don't loot is because there's people shoot. Not
Ridley didn't do the silent majority homework that much that they've been trying to pivot to through.
No. But there it is, Donald Trump using the, I wasn't quoting the Nazis, I was quoting the KKK defense. Got to hand it to him. Really thinking on its feet. Hey, folks, this episode, one of our sponsors, and you're going to hear a lot from them, they're sponsoring a bunch of shows. It is Sunset Lake CBD. They're located in Vermont, just outside of Burlington. It is a dairy farm. I think they're still producing dairy for Ben & Jerry's. I'm not sure. But in 2018, they started to diversify. They collaborate with the University of Vermont to practice responsible agricultural practices. Their hemp is 100% pesticide-free. They only use organic fertilizer. They're a great company that uses great business practices. They have their own $15 minimum wage. The majority of the company is owned by employees. And their CBD is amazing. I have not, you know, it's only recently that I even like started to try it. But I've tried other CBD tinctures, basically for sleeping purposes. And theirs, frankly, is been incredibly effective for me. And I got a chance to use a salve. I think somebody said salve. I don't know if that's right. Is it salve or salve? Whatever it is.
I think maybe in France it's salve.
I used it. That sounds like it would be like that in Italy. But I used it on my eczema. They don't even mention that. But I just did it because my eczema was driving me crazy on my hands. And knock on wood. I mean, I'm just telling you that it was effective. My sister had stolen my bottle for using it on her muscles. She loves it, but the tincture for me is helping me sleep in a way that I haven't had in years. Frankly, from anything other than like a Ambien. They also have gummy versions of CBD, but they have smokable CBD. Look at this. I mean, it looks like my daughter thought she had bagged me. But Matt, who is a CBD skeptic in terms of smoking, you've been raving about this stuff.
Yeah, and I went from skeptic to consumer. I basically have gone through the entire stash that since they sent me. So, yeah, really good, pleasant stuff. If you don't like the don't want to get paranoid smoking other things, you just want a nice calming effect, I think this is where you go.
They also got a CBD coffee, so you can check all this out, and you can get 20% off. They're fans of the shows, and they said they wanted to use the promo code LEFTISBEST, and I was like, awesome. And so it's LEFTISBEST, one word, 20% off at sunsetlakecbd.com. sunsetlakecbd.com. Check it out. I think you're going to be very happy you did. Lastly, a lot of folks shopping online these days, obviously. We want to stay away maybe from some major aggregators of online shopping. When you do, there's an easy way to make sure that you're not missing the coupon codes. You know, the coupon codes are all over the place, and I used to make my daughter sit down and search for coupon codes when she buys stuff. But thanks to Honey, you no longer have to actually manually search for coupon codes. Honey is a free browser extension that finds promo codes for you, automatically applies them to your cart. So, for instance, I just asked Myla, I said, what? Because she's using Honey, which means that I'm using Honey because I am saving money because she is saving money. I said, what was the last thing you bought that Honey saved you money? She immediately was like, Ulta. I don't know what Ulta is. I think it's like a beauty. She said she was buying makeup or some type of like facial cream. She saved $4, $15 to $11, she tells me, and did nothing. And I can guarantee you, if she was not using that, I would have made $15 for whatever that stuff was that she bought. Honey has found it's over 17 million members, over $2 billion worth in savings. It supports over 30,000 stores online. including DoorDash, Lululemon, Walmart. And it's, I mean, you know, I can tell my kids to look for coupons, savings online, or I don't have to worry about it because put Honey extension in our browser. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free money. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you're doing yourself a solid and you're supporting this podcast. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. All right. Don't forget, you can also support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the fun half and you get the free half free of commercials. So check that out. All right. Do we have Ben?
Yep. Here he comes.
Okay, great. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to present to you in all his video glory, the host and proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show.
Sam
Dixon himself. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Sam. How are you? I guess this is my first time doing video with you, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's great to see you. Nice SMB. What is that? It's the SMB7 you got going there.
Yeah, that's the one, man. It's the standard.
Do you need to power that up?
Do you need to power it? Yeah, you have to. Well, you don't have to power it up per se, but you do have to have a one of the cloud lifts to amplify, like a preamp, to get the signal. Otherwise, it's super quiet.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's been a problem in the past for me with that. I don't know why, but that maybe I got to get on that. Maybe I got to upgrade my microphone. Ben, I'm glad you're with us today. Obviously, every day now seems like it was like
a year
ago, but it also, you know, I can't even tell like one day starts and another one ends. But
yeah.
There was an election, a primary election, if you could call it that, I guess, Georgia this week. Yeah. And it was a crap show.
Yeah. 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 So particularly it was a crap show in the number of machines that did not work specifically in the black communities. And the amount of time that people had to wait, there were some people waiting in line till midnight, had some reports that police officers had to come and tell people it's time to go, because it was quote unquote private property, but that's how long people waited in line. The polls opened at 7 a.m. Tuesday, and the people who were in line at 7 did not get the chance to vote until after 9 o'clock because the machines kept breaking in. Somehow they only broke in minority communities, predominantly black communities versus suburban communities and white communities.
Obviously, look, Georgia has a long history of vote suppression. Kemp, you know, there's a lot of people who feel that Stacey Abrams, you know,
would be governor,
were it not for I think there's a very good reason to believe that this was sort of like a dry run for how you're going to run it on in November, right? I mean, they don't necessarily care who wins the Democratic primary, but they want to see, like, what's the tolerance for this, right? And apparently it's quite high. Like, is there anything happening on this court?
That's the thing. So there are people who are organizing now to address what happened. But that's the problem. It's not enough, right? There's not a full court press from the Democratic Party here. There's not a full court press from the National Democrats. And apparently the tolerance is very high. You even had in some of the local races, I mean, you had a higher turnout than usual, than you would suspect in a pandemic. You still had a significant number of black people show up to the polls, but still, because of the amount of time that they had to wait, a lot of them didn't get an opportunity to vote. So I agree with you. I think this is a dry run for November, because Georgia, if you actually just look at the demographics, if you look at the voter registration, Georgia is pretty blue. And I think that they're doing everything that they can. It's obvious that they're doing everything they can to keep it red as possible.
I mean, the thing that's really frustrating about this too is that, unlike, you know, voter ID, right, where activists can see that there's a problem. Okay, they're requiring voter ID, and they're you know, there's no, they've shut the DMV down in black communities, and People can actually get out there and say, like, we're going to do a campaign.
Organize around
we're going to drive right. people there. We're going to get people IDs. We're going to help them, this and that.
Right.
If it's a problem of voting places and it's a problem of voting machines, well, there's not much that the activists can do without right. going through the legislature, it seems.
Right. And really, because it's happening, it's the day of, right? A lot of times we've seen it in the past where you show up, you have a problem with voting, they give you a provisional ballot, and then there's all type of games that could be played with those provisional ballots. But the scale of this, Sam, is the biggest problem, right? The scale, there's simply not enough activists, there are not enough organizers, there's not enough attorneys who can be at all of these locations to ensure that everyone gets an opportunity to vote. And when the problem is malfunctioning machines, you know, it literally is everyone stands around until they figure out how to get the machines working. But again, they didn't have these problems in the non-black communities.
And is there vote by mail in Georgia?
Yes, there's vote by mail. But one big thing happened. A lot of people requested ballots and those ballots never came. And so they ended up having to go to the polls anyway on election day and waiting in line. So there's all kind of things that they're games that are going on in the state of Georgia. And again, it is a concerted effort to keep Georgia red because it has been trending blue. Every election has been trending bluer and bluer. And the increase in African-American turnout this time around really suggests that it's a threat to the Republican control in the state.
Let's talk a little bit about, the frustrating thing is like, I don't know what else there is to say at this point, but that's also part of the problem, right? It's
right.
like, you,
right.
there's these sort of just these, roadblocks that are there that unless like there are federal standards for vote by mail,
right.
Which,
right.
you know, I
think one of the things, Sam, don't mean to cut you off, but one of the things that could happen that we don't see happening is the full court press from Democrats, right? I mean, this should be, honestly, it should be everything that's talked about. This is all people should be talking about right now in terms of the Democratic Party. And I think what happens so often is that most of the motion that we see, most of the momentum that we see in this country really comes from the activists. Right. The people who are on the ground and then people in independent media and social media. Right. We create the stir. And without us actively creating the stir, nothing is happening around this. So I really am wondering, like, what is going on with the power of the Democratic Party infrastructure? Like, why are they not on the front lines using all that energy that they use to stop Bernie Sanders to leverage that same power to bring it to bear to stop the Republicans from suppressing the vote? I don't get that part.
Well, I don't think they have the same power to do that. But where's like, didn't we hear a lot about Obama and Holder were going to go out with, you know, millions of dollars of resources and be suing everybody? I mean, as far as I can tell.
As far as we can tell, there's no real action.
That's
there.
Ended. They filed some suits in Ohio. I mean, maybe they're more active than.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, so if they're active at this point, it's the public pressure, right? So if they are active, there needs to be a lot more publicity around it because we see things really change when the national consensus, when the minds of the masses start to be changed on an issue, but also just have something brought to their attention. I mean, that's literally how everything happened over the last couple of weeks. It was social media exposing the video of George Floyd that actually catapulted everything into action. And so if they are out there working, they need to publicize the hell out of it.
Right. And part of it is, as I would imagine, is that what happened in Georgia is competing for attention with what's happening around the country in terms of the protests, in terms of like the idea of changing the way that we police, the way police operate, you know, broadly and particularly in regards to the black community. Give me your sense of just like how, like, you know, it's hard to imagine we would have this type of movement. I'm going to talk more with David Roth, who's written a great piece about how the consensus of policing has radically changed, it seems to me, over the course of a month. You know, so much so that even Republicans are, at the very least, pretending to be out, you know, out there looking for police reform.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest victory out of the last month. Of course, the charges against the officers in the case of George Floyd, that's a victory. We're looking to get charges brought up against the police officers who shot and killed Breonna Taylor as she slept in her home. They were executing a no-knock warrant, and they went to the wrong house and killed 26-year-old Breonna Taylor. Go ahead,
Louisville, just passed a ban on no-knock warrants in the wake of that.
Right. So, I mean, and that is most certainly a victory. And shout out to all the activists on the ground there, the organizers who actually pressed, they really pressed hard to make that happen. Those officers are still at large, though. They're still, if I'm not mistaken, some of them are still working. So we're still trying to get justice in that regard. But one of the big victories over the last 2 weeks came at a very high cost. I want to start by saying the cost of this victory, right? The change in the minds of the American people with regard to who the police are. It came at a really high cost. A couple of people died. People lost their vision, lost sight. They got shot in the face with rubber bullets. The young woman who died because of exposure to tear gas. There's a lot of people who, and we don't even know the unseen cost at this point of people who were infected with COVID-19. We may never really know how much it cost for the American people to see just how vicious the police state really is. And something I said on my show for years, Sam, is like, you know, and I usually address this towards libertarians, like libertarians really do believe in the police state, but they always scoff when we talk about the police state in the Black community. But I always said on my show that the police state, which started and was their craft was honed in the Black community, was always going to spill over eventually. And that's what we saw last week. I mean, we saw them beating old white men. We saw them beating middle-aged, middle-income white women on television. And I think that was something that really shook the American consciousness. And so now there's a level of suspicion with which we look at police officers that Black folks have been trying to tell y'all about for a long time, but that's cool. I'm glad we're finally getting to the point where American can see the police for what they have always been in the Black community.
Well, what do you make of the, I'm trying to compare their response to what we saw during Occupy, and mm-hmm. we saw some of that behavior during Occupy,
yeah.
But it seemed, almost their response seemed to be, almost like, very cohesive, city to city to city.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even more violent than at that time. And I don't think I'm imagining that. I remember incidents in New York City, but they're during Occupy and obviously out the West Coast, Oakland, during Occupy. But it seems like across the country.
Yeah.
The response has been, much more violent by police.
Yeah.
What do you think that's a function of? Do you think that it's just like it's another 10 years and this has been the trajectory of police? Do you think it's a function of just like there's a, that quality of like it's Rudy's time type of attitude? I mean, what do you think it is?
I actually think it's both of those things, Sam. I think this has been the trajectory. We saw the escalation. Two things. We saw the escalation specifically during Ferguson, right? That was the first time we saw that large scale escalation where they were suppressing the press. I remember a whole thread of a reporter who was at McDonald's and got arrested in Ferguson, right? So it has been escalating, and this has been the natural trend. And you got to think about it, right? They are ever escalating in terms of what they spend their money on and the type of training and the type of militarization that they have been growing over the last 10 years. So I'm not surprised in the escalation. But then I think there's also another factor. This was a direct response to the police and a direct call for the police to be defunded. And they felt like this was an attack on their authorities. And so, of course, as soon as the mayors, that's the other thing I always have to point out. None of this went on without these Democratic mayors knowing about it, signing off on it, or turning a blind eye to it. However you want to say it, Bill de Blasio is just as culpable as anybody else. Keisha Lance Bottoms in Atlanta, she's just as culpable as anyone else. I don't care how many people they fire. There's not one rubber bullet that was fired that a Democratic mayor didn't know about. And so it was both an affront. It was natural escalation. This is where we've always been going, an affront to the police authority. But it was also the fact that we were protesting not only police violence, but the police state in general, which is a direct threat to the ruling class.
So what do you think happens now? I mean, the Democrats have put out a list of police reforms, all of which I think are necessary, but broadly speaking, significantly insufficient.
Yes.
I mean, I think like, you know, the, and I should say, there's also this sort of an ancillary argument, like, you know, Bernie Sanders put out a set of reforms himself. He specifically shied away from the defund, you know, semantics. But mm-hmm. if you look in his proposals, he is proposing limiting funds for cops and building sort of like parallel institutions and personnel who would take much of the cops' portfolio essentially and deal with it, whether it's unhoused folks or folks suffering from any type of mental issues or and so on, and obviously decriminalization of drugs.
Yeah.
Give me your sense of just sort of like where it goes from here. I mean, what do you think that should be done? I mean, bank these reforms and essentially like try and push forward. I mean, inevitably, it seems to me there's going to be some momentum loss
right.
as soon as you do that.
Right,
but at
right.
the same time, there's going to be momentum loss anyways, because next week we're due to be invaded by the aliens, and you know, people are going to be focused on that.
Yeah, no, honestly, that I agree with you. Like I'm fully expecting an asteroid to hit. It won't be a big enough asteroid to kill everybody, but it's going to be enough to be a natural progression in 2020. But to your point, I think one of the things that has to happen is that we continue using the power of social media. And I know this doesn't sound like much, but I want to show how significant it can be. I never really expected for us to successfully defund the police because of this incident. Certainly did not expect for us to be able to abolish the police because of this incident. But I do believe that we have won the narrative and that we can continue to win the narrative and change the minds of the American people. I think one of the most powerful things we can get from this is a general suspicion of police instead of a general belief that police are good. Right. When a police officer stood on a stand and to testified against the defendant, people always looked at that police officer as honorable and noble because he wore a badge. Now we see them as pigs. I've always seen them as pigs, but a lot of people just have a general distrust of the police officers now at this point. And that's what we need, because that's what they deserve. They don't deserve the free for all in terms of granting them and ceding them nobility, right? That's how they've leveraged it against us. And so if we can hit some strategic milestones here in terms of the funding, what the Democrats are offering is just woefully insufficient, right? They're talking about body cams. They're talking about banning the chokehold and things that have been, like in New York, I think it was 1993 where they banned the chokehold, but they still do it. And so I don't think we're going to get the victory we want in terms of defunding the police, but I think we can get the victory we need in terms of changing the national consensus around the integrity of the police.
Yeah, that's important. It's no longer a sacrosanct type of thing. And it's on some level, there has to be some type of undercutting of their political and
power
and right? institutional power. And,
right.
And so that in the next step after that's achieved is to actually like begin to sort of just shrink them as an institution.
Right. And I think those steps have to come, like we really have to just outlive these people like Jim Clyburn, Nancy Pelosi, and this entire generation that signed off on the 94 crime bill. Like, they are entrenched in power. We got to get them out of power. And once we get them out of there, I think there's a whole generation of people who have a totally different mindset with regard to police. And we just have to continue and not throw in the towel. But the number one thing that we gain ground on, we cannot let up on. And that is changing the national consensus about the behavior of police across this country.
You know, that's the generational thing. And I know that I probably am guilty of investing maybe too much into this, but I am convinced. And I say that only because I hesitate to put too much. I don't want to invest too much in that because it creates a sense of like, there's both an inevitability and mm-hmm. a futility of pushing it past a certain
right.
point. But
right, I feel that.
I really do think that what we're seeing is the emergence of millennials mm-hmm. who, you know, like we have two big generations that are on the court, as it were, right now. on the playing field. And that's boomers and millennials. Mm-hmm. And Gen Xers like myself, I didn't grow up at a time like, you know, I didn't grow up at a time where I saw the need for a civil rights act or a voting rights act or, you know, the stopping of like literally government programs that were, racially discriminatory. I mean, these right. things all existed almost up to the point where I was born, but I didn't grow up with the existence of these things. My attitudes are definitely different, towards, black people and society's relationship with black people and brown people, and women for that matter, and gay people. But they were diminished, I guess, you know, sort of the worst of it was diminished from generations before me. But my generation was too small to impact any change whatsoever. Mm. We were always living in the boomers culture.
Yeah.
And I think we're at like a tipping point where millennials, it's their culture.
Yeah.
They're the citizens. They're the consumers. They have the most, you know, cultural power. They have the most political power, not quite political power, but they have the most cultural power at this point.
Yeah. But they're gaining that political power.
Yes. And they're gaining that political power. They're not quite there yet, but they have the most cultural power, it seems to me. And that's why obviously we have this greater context in which this stuff is happening, but their response seems to be driving this.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I'm right there on the cusp, like, right there. I'm both a millennial as well as Gen X, like right there at 1980. And I agree, like part of my life was living in the shadow of boomers but having a suspicion that something was wrong. Right. We kind of grew up in a period where everybody pretended like everything was fine. 1992, when we saw, Rodney King being beat, like that was one of the first major cultural shifts in that generation. Right. And now we're living in a generation where we see that every day, like every single day, we see two or three Rodney Kings happening on a regular basis. So millennials, people who are like solidly millennial, they grew up with wars. They grew up with, clear examples of corrupt politicians and the Supreme Court snatching away a victory from in 2000. Like they grew up with two recessions, now a pandemic. Like Zoomers and millennials, I can't wait till I see a time when they look at me and call me a conservative, right? I'm not going to change my politics. I'm going to get a little bit more radical as I get older, but the younger generation, they're going to look at us and be like, you guys are just milquetoast conservatives. And I think in general, that's a good thing because of how far right this country has shifted over the last generation or two.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that happens to me already on some level. And I, you know, like I say, I welcome it. I mean, it's pretty awesome to see. And it's awesome to see how that perspective on cops has changed dramatically. I mean, to the point where even a Democratic Party, which is in many respects dominated by boomers, literally, and certainly still dominated by the boomer mentality.
Yeah.
And I don't want to offend people who are boomers who are listening to this. I mean, I understand it. You know, I'm talking about overall the generation, you know, my generation was also very Reagan, oriented.
Yes.
So I'm not too happy with Gen Xers in that regard too. I don't think you're necessarily because you're a boomer, is your disposition, but I'm saying I think like Ryan Grimm's book, really the thesis of it is that many of the leaders today learn their lessons in politics from the early 90s and in the wake of the Reagan era.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I'm talking about. That is that was sort of the consensus for that generation. This is also the consensus, I think, for my generation as well.
But that's the difference between like that's the difference between the Pete Buttigieg of the world, where he came in like he's a generation too late, like he's an election cycle too late. He grew up with that kind of training and that mentality of being a more progressive sounding Ronald Reagan, when in reality the Gen X and younger Gen Xers and millennials and Zoomers are like, absolutely the hell not, that time is gone. So they missed the boat on that one.
Let's talk about Donald Trump is going to be giving a speech in Tulsa, Oklahoma next weekend on Juneteenth.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to know, right? Like, I don't think they're terribly sophisticated, but they had to know.
Oh, no. That's the point, man. The cruelty is the point. It's always the point. They're trying to rub it in. And they know. I don't know if you wanted to, you were about to say a whole lot more there.
No, go ahead. Go.
Yeah. So the cruelty is the point. They are rubbing it in, but here, I'm not so upset about it so much as we have to understand the real agenda here. When he goes to Tulsa, and he does it on Juneteenth, he's going to be flanked by black people, right? He's going to be flanked by black preachers and all the people who he has on his payroll to make sure that he doesn't look as racist as his dog whistle sound, right? So he's going to be doing two things at once. He's going to be dog whistling to his audience that, hey, 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 I own this. This black holiday, this city that was ravaged by the Tulsa race massacre, where they killed hundreds of black people and devastated an entire thriving, booming black community in 1921. He said, I own this, and his supporters are going to love it. But at the same time, he's going to try to walk the tightrope of co-opting blackness and trying to bring it over into the column of protecting this white male Christian power structure in this country. So that's the job of Stephen Miller. He's writing the speech. So the real question is can Stephen Miller get over his natural lust for white supremacy enough to help Donald Trump walk that tightrope where he can try to convince black, he's trying to convince black people that the real way to be black is to support his type of ideologies.
I feel like Miller, I think he can get into the right mind frame if he just can convince himself that this appeasement of black people is in service of white supremacy.
Oh yeah,
that he'll be able to fashion something that yeah. work. The other interesting thing to note on that day is, he's also forcing people to sign a waiver,
right?
You know, Oklahoma, I don't think has a particular problem, but you know, he is going to go to Arizona, and Arizona, it's conceivable within a couple of weeks is going to bust through their threshold of what their hospitals can contain.
Can handle. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Brendan, do we have that clip of, I think it was in Arizona. I don't know if it was a state official who,
The public health official.
Yeah. Public health official. Look at this. Let's play this. This is sort of stunning. Like, all the flattening of the curve was really about making sure that we did not have deaths that mm-hmm. were a function of not being able to provide medical care for them because there was so many people coming into the hospital. And they are racing towards that precipice. Mm. This is what their public health official had to say.
We have halted elective surgeries and allowed facilities to request exemptions from that executive order, and we have issued a stay-at-home order. And the goal for those mitigation strategies was really to slow the spread so that we could ensure that we had adequate hospital capacity. We know that it's in the community. We are not going to be able to stop the spread, and so we can't stop living as well.
Mm. In other words, we're just going to see what happens, basically. Yeah. Not there's, you know, there's, it really is stunning to me. The anti-science push that we saw during the Bush years is really in many respects coming home to roost.
It's on the next level, Sam. The idea that the way we have decided in America to deal with this pandemic is to just, okay, we're going to absorb the brunt of it, right? And that we are at 115,000 people who are dead already. And at this rate, we're probably going to see closer to 250,000, probably before this year's over. And that's a lowball estimate. It is a level of ignorance and stupidity that is embraced by so many people in this country that we can't negate it. We can't just dismiss it and laugh at them anymore. During the Bush era, we laughed at their stupidity, right? Now we can't afford to laugh at their stupidity because their stupidity is about to get a lot of people killed.
But it's not just stupidity. It is a willful ignorance.
It's weaponized. It's weaponized ignorance.
It is a weaponized ignorance, exactly. Like, look. Yeah. We definitely cannot be in lockdown for however long this is going to exist. But the idea that wearing a mask has become some type of like, you know, God's guns and deficit, whatever it is, some type of signifier for the right is just absurd.
Right.
Like the cost of wearing a mask is so negligible. Low.
Right.
And it is the really the one thing that people can do that can really genuinely mitigate the chances of other people catching it.
Right. Right.
And it's the idea, and it costs virtually nothing.
Right. Well, the masks are starting to cost a little bit more. I saw a package of 50 for $50. I'm like, okay, you got to love capitalism. But in terms of like your social costs, it literally costs nothing. And in fact, like if they were serious about opening the economy again safely, then everyone would say, okay, we can reduce transmission significantly by everybody wearing a mask, but that's not good enough. Right. It's because, whose article was that? I think it was, Ryan Cooper's article about them, making the culture war. They turned this into the culture war. Yeah. Wearing a mask is a part of the culture war at this point. And because of that, they are willing willing to die on behalf of this new virtue signal that they have inside of their own culture war. And it's funny how they always throw virtue signaling at us, but now they're virtue signaling in a way that's going to get them killed. And they're going to sign a waiver to go to these rallies. Yeah. Right. I just don't know. So it is, I agree with you. It's weaponized ignorance, but it's at a level that's going to cost so many innocent lives.
And let me also be clear here. You don't need to buy a mask. You can cut up an old t-shirt. You can cut up and still, you can still protect other people by wearing that. Is that effective? No, but is it 60% more effective? That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, and I didn't want to touch on this in this moment, but screw it. I'm seeing a lot of people, and some on the left or ostensibly on the left, who are, this growing streak of left contrarianism of people saying there, you know, what's going on with the idea that you can go to protests,
right?
But coming out or demanding that we open up our economies and whatnot are not equivalent. And I want to get your take on this, but let me just plant this flag. First off, those people on who are pushing for the economy to come out, those people in Michigan with their showing up with their guns, and the people who did it in California, they are, to push their point, they are in denial as to the reality of COVID.
Right.
They are not going and saying, we're equally weighing these things and we're looking clear headed at these two things.
And
one is real and the other is also real, but this one outweighs that. And we're going to do everything we can to mitigate the COVID as we do this. Whereas the protesters, they're out there, the vast majority of them wearing masks.
Yeah.
The cops aren't, but the vast majority of the protesters are. They're not denying the reality of COVID. They're simply saying, this is so compelling that I am willing to risk what I know is a real danger to go out and do this. Whereas the other people start with the denial of COVID.
Right.
They say this is something that is being foisted on us.
Mm-hmm.
Then they say, and I want my, you know, liberty to not wear a mask. This is absurd that you could make an equivalence here. It is a blight on science. It is a blight on, even if you don't get to the point of like, you know, it's fighting this injustice is more important than being able to go get a haircut. You don't even have to get there to make a valid critique of what these people are arguing by saying COVID's not real. Therefore, you're just trying to control me by forcing me to wear a mask.
Well, Sam, that's because there's disingenuous actors, and I don't say that in terms of a platitude. I know everyone understands that there's a lot of bad faith actors out there, but the power of bad faith arguments is one where they try to neutralize the protest in our mind, right? They're really trying to convince us that we're the same as the people who are out there trying to open up their business by denying that COVID even exists, right? They want to make it, they want to nullify, they want to neutralize everyone's righteous indignation. And the way they do that that is by they have to draw an equivalence between their anger and our anger. Their anger that says, you're violating my liberties because you're making me wear a mask, versus our anger that says, stop killing us. And the people who are doing this are not only conservatives, but there's some people in the so-called left. We all know who we're talking about. We won't call any names, but there's a lot of them, right? And so this is the thing that I've had to stress significantly and expend a lot of social capital on, is by convincing people that your protests are valid. Right? Because the number one thing they're trying to do, they're trying to say you're no better than the people who are out here trying to open up their restaurants. No, I don't care if I get any Dave and Buster's or any chicken wings. These people are sacrificing their lives and their safety on behalf of a problem that they feel is so significant that their lives are worth risking for it. Like, you cannot draw equivalence between those people and their righteous indignation and the angry people over there. So we have to stop letting them draw that equivalence. Righteous indignation is what's driving us, and just pure opportunistic anger is what's driving them.
And I am happy to entertain that argument if they're going to be sincere about what it is.
Right.
I.e., getting a haircut is the equivalent of fighting against police brutality. Yeah. And that, in addition, they also have to embrace the attitude that those people have, that COVID is overblown. And that this is a fiction, or at least its danger is fictionalized.
But you know, they can't say that.
Well, that's right. And there's a lot of, like, I gotta say, and there's people I've lost a tremendous amount of respect for, not because of their positions, but because of how disingenuous they are in presenting it.
Yeah, that's when I jump off the boat, man. Like, I can't, like, once I realize that you are willing to argue in bad faith just to preserve your
brand.
Posturing, brand. Your brand, like you're no good to the entire conversation at this point.
Ben Dixon,
Michael Tracy, no,
what's it?
Never mind.
No, fuck Michael Tracy. I'm not, like, I don't even, like, he doesn't even reach the bar of me ever having any type of respect. I'm sorry. I didn't even, like, no, I wasn't. I wouldn't. I my voice is too damaged to waste any time discussing his bullshit. Ben Dixon, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoy it. Folks can check out the Benjamin Dixon Show, and I can't press upon them enough to do so. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Be safe up there.
Talk to you soon. Next up, ladies and gentlemen, this is just amazing how much content we actually produce every day. What great commentators and writers. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the a former writer from Deadspin, and now writing, you know, wherever, like, major publications can corral him, writing a couple of pieces in the New Republic. David Roth, welcome to the program.
It looks like he's still transitioning between the waiting room and live. So
that sounds like a science fiction.
Oh, here he is.
This is an elaborate bit we cooked up.
There we go.
Hello.
Hello, David Roth. Welcome to the program. Now, are you freelance writing these days?
Yeah. I mean, that's the best way to say it.
Okay. Fair enough. Then that's the way I'll say it. Right. There are two pieces that you wrote just in the past couple of days of the New Republic, which I thought were fantastic.
Thanks.
But first off, welcome. I don't know if you heard my first welcome to you, because you were apparently transitioning from the waiting room into the...
Yeah, I was. There's a rigorous vetting process that basically involved me having to quit Zoom a bunch of times, but here I am.
Well, we're following the New York City DOE protocols to make sure that nobody interferes with our Zoom calls. And that's why we've got to be very, stringent, but, let's start. I want to start. I hope you're well and, making your way through this
as well as can be expected, I guess, you know?
Yeah. All right.
Fair. I had my second haircut of quarantine. We're adapting. We're doing what we can.
Someone else did it for you, or did you do it yourself?
My wife did it, and did a pretty good job, I think. There's one little, like, nibble here that, like, that was the first thing she did that took it down to, like, that.
Still have mine over here from when I think my daughter, I don't know which side it is, my daughter, it took a huge chunk out, and then I was like, you know what, maybe I'll do with this.
Yeah.
But I just did my son's haircut, and it came out pretty well. I'm using like a shears and
wow. Yeah, these were just like the crappy beard trimmer that I had, and it was sort of like, I don't know, both of us got mildly high and thought we'd experiment, like play with my look.
There you go.
Happens.
Well, you look very dapper. Thanks, I appreciate man. You. I'm glad that we have you on video for this. You wrote a piece, The Twilight of the Cop Consensus, and I thought it was a really good piece. I want to let me read just a little bit. I rarely do this, but there was a couple of things that you wrote that I think really capture this. And you know, I spoke a little bit about this with Ben Dixon early in the program, but. I think this is really sort of, I'm really fascinated by this because I think we're going to see this moment, what happened here play out in a couple of other areas. It's important to recognize, you wrote, that the emerging movement to defund police forces is more about, is about more than that particular laudable goal. More fundamentally, it's about reversing the dereliction that left states and cities spending more than half their budgets on harm infliction and the meager rest on literally everything else. Seen from this vantage, the rationale for the exorbitant funding of the police stems from their de facto mandate to manage the fallout from the many other challenges that the state has effectively chosen not to address. That's at the heart, in many respects, of at least the solution that what we talk about with defunding, which is an analogous problem that we have with teaching, and I would argue probably across the board in many areas, which is we have these societal ills. Instead of addressing them directly, what we do is we, at least in terms of the cops and in terms of the teachers, we expect them to deal with it. We don't necessarily fund them to deal with it.
Yeah.
But with the cops, we just throw a bunch of money in there and basically say, sweep this under the rug. And apparently they decided to do it in the most violent way possible.
It's I think that's a good distinction that you're making there too, because it's like, I'm, you know, for obvious reasons, like it's hard to, like, I don't want to make myself like the center of the movement to defund the police for any particular reason or whatever. But it's seeing that dynamic that you just described play out over and over again in terms of like, it's not even a less expensive way of doing it. It's just a more violent way of doing it. But that it's like to see like what happens when you've got one party that vehemently wants the government not to work. And then you have another one that sees its job as mitigating that process instead of actually stopping it or reversing it. And, you know, so this is what you get. Like, this is what it takes to keep people pacified when you have taken from them everything that they believe their tax dollars are paying for.
That was actually the second quote that I had.
Sorry.
And the last one was the inevitable outcome of the unspoken and unexamined political consensus that the job of the state is to make sure both that the right people are protected and the right people get hurt. Conservatives actively work to enhance it. Liberals have accepted that their job is to try and mitigate it. Actually remaking it was, until very recently, not part of the conversation. And now it is.
Yeah.
And why do you think it is now as opposed to, I don't know, years ago?
It's hard to figure that part out. I mean, I think the video, you know, you can see why people got in the streets because of the George Floyd thing. Like, it really is as horrible as any image could be. And as like, you know, as sort of like a crystalline expression of like what that type of policing really does do to people, like, and communities. I think the thing that sort of has triggered this response in, you know, that has like opened up these sort of like broader avenues of discussion is like comes down to how much the cops fucked up in responding to these protests, how like hyper aggressive and violent and again, and like an ineffective it was. I mean, that's the other sort of, there's reasons, you know, that we can, I don't even know if it qualifies as speculation, why like a bunch of cops were standing in Times Square waiting to hit polluters with batons while like five blocks east they're looting, you know, the Louis Vuitton store on Fifth Avenue. Like, that, it's clear that if they wanted to stop that looting, they could have done more to do it. They didn't.
Right.
That was, you know, whether that was a strategic decision or not. I think it's just like to see all of these different failures happening concurrently, the pandemic, policing, that like the basic enforcing of order in a way that doesn't look like a boot on a neck. Like, every bit of that is failed at the same time. And I think that that's like the feeling in the streets. I don't want to make it seem like I'm out protesting all the time or, you know, whatever, throwing a garbage can through the window of Sal's Pizza or whatever. Like, I've done my little bits of marching and, like, you know, but I feel like people have come to the realization that this shit just isn't working and that the people in charge on both sides are not capable of making it work. And so seeing where that, you know, sort of frustration goes is going to be the interesting part. But it's already heartening, I think, to see that it's not going in the directions that Republicans have traditionally tried to channel it. That it's not the sort of thing where it's like, just find some, you know, marginalized community to take the shit out on and demand a tax cut when you're done. Like, I think people want not to live like this.
I mean, you know, Ben made this point, and obviously your piece makes this point that the that what has changed, at least in the you know, in the past month. I mean, you know, obviously, like you know, these things sort of build up over time, and then, you know, there's almost like a spike in the yeah. way that, and that's the way, you know, I feel like everything happens is that there's a spike. And it drops down, but to a baseline that is not where the old baseline was.
Right.
And that is that the institution of the police is problematic in a way that it wasn't sort of recognized before. And that, like you say, people are starting to contemplate remaking. And we've seen it in the response from the Democratic Party. I mean, 15 years ago, I know how the Democrats would have responded to this. They would have just sounded like the Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, as much as they could, like you say, but with some mitigation, but it would have been, you know, they would have fallen there. They would have still been sort of enthralled by that, law and order. And as ham-fisted and as, I think, you know, not up to the task of actual, the reform that's needed, you know, they did dress in their outfits and kneel,
yeah.
which at the very least, you know, and I do mean it's the very least they could do.
Yeah.
But it was the like most. Their way. I mean, I saw this clip of like this meme where someone said, like, I told mom that, you know, I was having a black friend over. And so they, you know, they dress up like that. Completely not capable of rising to the moment, but some notion of like, not running away from it in the way that they used to before.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shame that that's, I think that's exactly right. It's a shame that that's where the bar is at this point, that it's like, whatever, grandma doing some like sort of cringe gesture, like whatever,
right.
dressing like fucking Professor X from the X-Clan and like, you know, hitting the kneel. But at the same time, it shows that they, as difficult as it would be for the highest ranking Democrat elected officials to recognize this, because they're all like, 73 years old and have four homes, you know? So it's like, there's only so much that you can really get through to them. It's clear that like they have at least seen that this is not going away. And I think that your point about where the plateau is, that this is like maybe where we're taking off from after Ferguson, right? That like this is, because what that, I mean, there was a Democratic president and there was a DOJ that was not dedicated to doing the opposite of what the DOJ is supposed to do. So like, those are some differences from the time that we're in now. But like, what that gave us was like this spate of police reforms and all that like kind of eight can't wait shit, where it's, you come up with new rules and new sort of forms to fill out, all the sort of technocratic liberal responses to things. And, you know, so they adhered, some departments adhered to that, like all of them grudgingly. Yeah.
Minneapolis was
right.
One.
Seven of the eight can't wait things.
I mean, that was, you know, I mean, that's, on some level, that's really helpful that they did that, mm-hmm. because we just ran the experiment. And if you're a technocrat, you got to look at the data and guess what? Didn't work.
Yeah.
Got to do something different.
And this is, I think, what goes back to what you were saying about in terms of like, as corny as it is to see like Chuck Schumer in kente cloth, like sort of it, like at the very least, that can't be where it ends. Like even they, I think, realize that like throwing more rules and new sort of like, you know, half a loaf type solutions to like massive institutional abuses is not like, that's not it. Like, it won't move the needle. And it also, like you said, like, we already know what it does, which is basically, like, departments either ignore it or scoff at it, or they find, like, as Minneapolis did, like, just new ways to commit new abuses. I was reading a story from the Star Tribune earlier today that they apparently, for years, cops would just get EMTs to inject people with ketamine, like, just to calm them down. They would sedate them with stuff, which is, and, you know, like, no consent from, obviously, from the people. Most of them were having sort of mental health emergencies, but they weren't, in many cases, they weren't even being arrested. And the cops would just be like, do you mind dosing this person? They're annoying me. Like, just incredible shit.
I mean, I think the, one of the things that, you know, was a debate in Occupy was, that came out of one of the subcommittees on essentially proposing new financial regulations, and the document that they produced was considered to be like significantly better than any think tank produced, et cetera, et cetera. Was this concept of, you know, we can either try and do these sort of surgical regulations on the banking industry, or, you know, or we can take a meat cleaver and just basically, you know, make sure that there's no room. We don't need those surgical things. Yeah. We're gonna cut off part of the, you know, whatever. We're gonna cut off part of the arm. We're gonna cut off the arm so that we're not playing around with the gangrene. Let's right. put it that way.
In, like, or instead of coming up with new things that you can do with your arm,
exactly.
It's like whatever, like a hand checking rule in the NBA or whatever. That like, I think that that's like the real.
And I think we're about to see the failure of the not cutting off the arm.
Yeah.
Because the gangrene has returned.
Yep.
And they did new things, and it's not going to be CDOs, but it could be these, like, basically these junk bonds that corporations have. They're over-leveraged. I mean, we may end up seeing that, but the point being is that I feel like we're entering into an era where there is going to be increased awareness that these surgical fixes are just simply not working.
Yeah.
You know, even on their own terms, you have to sort of like, even if you're a technocrat, and I have no problem with technocrats, but look at the data. You've run your experiment. It didn't work.
Right. And so that's like, and that's a real sort of a challenging thing, I think, for a party that especially like, I mean, Obama was like the apotheosis of this because he's like the closest thing to an actual smart guy that's been president during my lifetime. Right. But that like, they had all these like clever ideas that they sort of, seemingly, you know, wherever you could implement them, that they chose like the most sort of clever, subtle response to things, not all of which are like objectionable on their merits. It's just like they don't do the job as well as some of the like dumb, obvious, this is illegal and you can't do it now measures. Right. The same way, you know, whatever with healthcare, it's the same deal that like you create an exchange and you create all these incentives and tax breaks and you nudge people in various directions or other. But like, you can also just fucking give them the healthcare and take all that stuff off the table. And like, while that is kind of like oafish and old fashioned and like, you know, Lyndon Johnson-y, it also would have the added benefit of conferring healthcare to individuals.
Let me, and I ask this at the risk of, and I certainly don't want to, I don't want to, you know, turn the page on this moment in terms of what we're doing in terms of police reform, particularly in the context of the Black community. But we're also on the precipice. I don't know if we're 3 weeks away or 5 weeks away or 8 weeks away from really the, what's happened to the economy is really going to start to land. Some level, I feel like the tide has been out, or the, you know, it's like that moment before the tsunami where the water comes out and goes, well, it's really pleasant. Everything seems to be very quiet right now. It's weird. And all of a sudden, I think like we can start to see the water coming back in, and, you know, we're going to see unemployment benefits run out in, about 5 or 6 weeks. We're going to start to see these moratoriums on evictions are ending across the country. Colorado tried to extend theirs. No luck. We're going to start to see austerity heading into now Q3. We're going to start to see austerity in state and local governments across the board. And I think there's going to be, we're going to start to see real pain. I mean, It's not like we haven't, but I think what we've had now is anxiety and anticipation of real pain. People have lost their jobs. They've been slow to get maybe, unemployment benefits, but they had this sense that it was coming. But now the sense is it's ending.
Yeah.
And states are going to start cutting back on their services. It's a great time to cut back on the cops right now, frankly. And then, you know, when it comes time for refunding, you've refund other places. But it does not appear like we're going to get a federal bill anytime before then. What do you think happens with this energy? And how much of is it a problem to sort of like, I mean, I can't help but think on some level, like the energy is going to migrate, but it's also, I have mixed feelings about that because we're at a moment where we can actually get genuine reform maybe in this sort of silo of policing. But the amount of pain is going to sort of like widen and shift. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of it's going to hit the Black community in terms of evictions. It's going to hit low income communities. It's going to hit brown communities.
Basically everybody that, you know, suffers the most from over policing, bad policing is going to suffer from all of the other shit.
Yeah. And COVID for that matter. And the ones who lost their jobs in this instance.
So it's hard to, say obviously where it's going to go, but I think that like there is this sense that it all fits into the same critique and into the same sort of structure that like none of this stuff happens if, well, I mean, a pandemic is a pandemic, right? You can do more to mitigate it than this administration did. It would be very difficult to do less to mitigate it than the administration did, but you know, it's a thing that happens. The struggle to like this idea that they settled on where they like this sort of bargained agreement with a fucking disease where it was just like, well, we're going to give it 3 months. Like everybody do your best for 2 months, like try to wear your masks. Like if you can't do it because you don't like them, that's fine. Like whatever. So we settled on that. And I think broadly speaking, people did the right things. They wanted to do the right things and we made no progress on it. Like it don't really seem like anybody sort of worked on it. And so the failure of that and then the more urgent and sort of violent failure that the protests are addressing, like it's all part of the same failure. And the police are the way that power makes that failure bearable for them. That like, this is the thing that sort of keeps it in check. But I think, as you said, as this gets worse, you know, that like the institution that handles evictions are cops.
Right.
That this is like, it's just going to be the same face of the state on this, on a, you know, now a half dozen different failures at the same time. I don't think people are going to stop being angry. Like for whatever that's worth.
Point that about evictions. That's a great point. It hadn't even occurred to me, but that could be the next flashpoint that we see with the police. And the real question is like, how are they going to address this? Because, you know, it is, they're going to be specifically like very blatantly, this is going to be a defense of property posture that they're going to have to take in this instance. And that's going to be interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. Yeah.
And a much more urgent sort of defense of property thing than the, like the standard argument about stuff like this is always like, well, think about like the mom and pop Foot Locker franchise that got looted or whatever. This is somebody's fucking house.
Right.
You know, like, and it really is, I think, going to happen a lot. So it's really scary to think about, man. It's hard.
I think it was well said, the idea that we were sort of like bargained with this disease. I mean, at some level, it's like, you know, I have this, it's like this dynamic with my kid where it's just like, after a while, he just like is yelling and crying and screaming and kicking so much that it's like, okay, fine. Watch another episode of TV. Yep. And on some level, that's sort of like what it feels like we have done. But the idea is that like, you know, we didn't, when you say we didn't make any progress on this, that is like, we didn't develop any contact tracing. We didn't develop any sort of like, I've seen multiple different things published by, you know, some doctors in Michigan or, you know, the Times does a survey of epidemiologists. Like, where is the United States government saying we have convened this panel of epidemiologists to come up with these guidelines, that these are the guidelines you need for, you know, and the CDC puts out something and then backs off it, and then we don't hear from them. And,
yeah. It's all out there, but it's like, it's on their website. Like, they don't talk about it because it upsets the president. I mean, I like, as cheesy as it is to like make it about the orange guy, like that's what it is. I mean, that, like, he thinks that by acknowledging that the pandemic is going on, it's going to make him less popular, which is true. It will, like, not quite as unpopular as his handling of it. But the idea that you can just somehow at some point just put your head down and ignore it and like get back to normal, like, I don't think that that's on the menu in the way that they think that it is. Like, the idea, like, you can say that the Cheesecake Factory is open again, but like, no one's going to go to it.
And then if they do, which I think, they're going to get, they're like, it may not happen in the first couple of weeks, but eventually the virus is out there and eventually it's going to be like, make its way to the parking lot of the Cheesecake Factory. And somebody's going to get it, and they're going to walk into the Cheesecake Factory, and then all of a sudden, people in the Cheesecake Factory are going to get it. And I feel like that's going to be the story in the run-up to the election, or, you know, after the election. I mean, you know, we can't, like you say, you can't negotiate with this thing.
Yeah.
You can only mitigate it, but now it's become, you know, if you're, you know, definition of a secular, you know, humanist, I guess, is somebody who wears a mask when they're out socializing with people.
Yeah, that turning it into that like a symbolizing thing where it's like if you wear a mask, you're like whatever virtue signaling or like cucking yourself or whatever. It's like, I mean, obviously it was always going to go that way because that's what like everything in our culture is now. Where like somebody walking down the street drinking a Mountain Dew, like, sorry, does this offend you? It's got caffeine in it, like. It's pathetic, but that is like where we wind up. The idea that like public health could somehow become that, you know, just become another way to like fucking trigger the other side, or like, it's worrying. But I think that like the idea, I was talking to a friend about this, about the hilarious reopening plan for the NBA season, that like, I think that we're stuck in this like bargaining stage of grief in terms of like reckoning with the failure to actually deal with any of this stuff. And so everybody's still kind of pretending like there's things we can do.
But there are things that we can do.
There are. We just haven't done them. Like if we had a more robust testing thing, if we had contact tracing, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to have like basketball. Honestly, like it'll be a while before I want to play basketball with anyone again. Like the idea of just like the few times I've like bumped into someone at like a protest, it's like touching a hot stove. Like I've completely rewired my mind to be just like, no, you know, like. That's not what we do now.
But the weird thing is, in other parts of the country, there's none of that.
Yeah.
And a part of it is because New York City is the epicenter, and you know, I'm outside the city right now, but the proximity to the city, people got that in their heads.
Yeah.
But if you're talking like Arizona or Michigan or you know, a lot of these other places. People are just like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, it doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, they're going to have to go through it. It's happening there now, but it's like, it's weird that they got to watch this happen to New York and Seattle and New Orleans and Chicago and all that on TV. And then sort of like see as those like curves were flattened. I think it makes sense, especially like you said earlier, in like the absence of any coherent message or leadership from the federal government, that they would be like, oh, well, that's over. Like we did it. Like New York beat it.
There is this sort of, I feel like there's this, I don't know what, I can't come up with an analogy. And there's a lot of spiking of footballs that are taking place. And I don't think we're there in terms of, I don't think we have any idea what awaits on the other side of this field in terms of like the economy or perhaps this disease. But yeah.
I'm sure it'll be fun. Whatever it is.
It's going to be so fun. And for you, it's going to be a great opportunity to write about stuff.
Oh, it's terrific. That's why I have been so happy and been sleeping so well late. Is the thing that the last New Republic thing I did was like 100% me just chugging garbage for an entire week and then like writing a story about it, which what, I'm glad that I was able to like monetize it.
Was that the twilight of the cop consensus or the American Psycho? Because I wanted to talk to, because the other weird part about this, and let me just ask just briefly about this. Like this whole part of the story in any other era would be the story, right? Like the fact that like, oh, the White House has just basically now been reduced to county supervisor. You know, Boss Hogg has basically won and he's just handing out stuff to his nephew. And they're just like, like this is the White House is now being run like a small town corruption where it's just like, we got some state money. Great. You know, hey boys, come on. You're going to buy the property because we're going to do I-90 is going to go right through your back door and that type of shit. And you wrote about that in terms of Kushner, and that's all that we've seen, except for now it's being applied to a pandemic.
Yeah. So the Kushner story is weird. Because it was for the print magazine, I wrote it. That was like 3 weeks ago. And, you know, before the protest blew up and before all of this. And so it felt like sort of a relic of another time. Like, it's not like you can't get mad about Jared Kushner fucking up six different things every single day as like part of his job as one of the three people that's allowed to make decisions in the White House or whatever. But like, it's not the thing that people were angry about before, but in reading it back over, I was like, oh yeah, this actually sucks ass. Like, this is really bad. And Kushner himself, I mean, the story is mostly about how he sort of assembled this sort of shadow procurement team out of management consultant people that were sort of, they were working for free. They were basically sort of like donated to the federal government to buy PPE but mostly to like answer emails from Trump's friends. Like Jeanine Pirro asked for a hospital to get a bunch of masks and they sent it to him. And it's like, so that's the corrupt, you know, like county government part that you're saying.
The other patronage. Bit of
it, yeah, is that it feels like a shitty family business. Like it's like just a mismanaged Quiznos franchise with like a lot of backstabbing and a lot of like kind of mediocre people scheming in dumb guy ways about stuff, which is like, if it's a bad way to run your Quiznos, and I know Quiznos doesn't exist anymore. I miss Quiznos. They toasted the sandwiches.
I understand.
Was solid. But like, if that's not a way to run a franchise, then like running this incredibly difficult, you know, task like that is even worse.
Do you think that the utter absence of a response that could even be sort of like it's almost like immeasurable, their response to this?
Yeah.
Because it's so like, it's literally like they show up on a baseball field with a basketball and start to kick it.
Numbers are outlandish with that.
Like, how do you like even like say like you're bad at baseball? You're kicking a basketball you brought.
Exactly.
Like, it doesn't even like their absence of any type of response, is that creating some more space or less space for the type of protest and pushback that they're getting?
I think that's a really interesting question. My instinct is to say that it's more, but it's also, again, it like is pointing back to the same sort of critique that all of this sort of fits into, which is that like the idea of being like, all right, well, we got to take this out of the hands of the cops and put it in the hands of some higher authority. Like the higher authority isn't doing anything. Like they've been on vacation since March. And so the idea of like, it just makes you sort of feel abandoned in a way that like the idea that like obviously that the White House didn't take this seriously is disgusting and scandalous and enraging and all of that. But there's also like to see the extent to which they failed, that like all of this stuff, you know, they get up there and say that they're going to do something without a plan to do it. And then the thing I keep coming back to is the idea of those remote, like sort of drive through testing facilities.
Right.
And they were like, we're going to have these in every state. We're partnering with Walgreens or whatever. And then there was like 40 of them 3 weeks later in the entire country. Like, if you're going to say that you're going to do something and you don't know how to do it, and then you don't do it, like, where does that sort of leave you as a concerned citizen? Right. Like, it just makes it seem like you need to radically reexamine and rebuild everything that is designed to facilitate this, because it's not, like you said, it's not like a failure of like scope or scale or whatever. Like, it is like an error of kind. Like, they right. authentically do not know what the job is and can't do it.
That actually may be a great title for this era.
Feels good.
Authentically don't know what the job is, nor can they do it.
Yeah.
David Roth, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We're going to put a link to both those pieces on majority.fm.
Thanks,
stay safe, and thanks for joining us.
Right on. You too. See you.
All right, folks. That brings us to the end of our free half of the program today. It's Friday. I'm going to endeavor to persevere, do fun half with the, like I say, only 60% of my vocal skills today. But I will take this opportunity to remind you that it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Your support, very much appreciated. If you want the fun half, but you don't have the funds, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have patience. If for some reason you haven't heard from us in like a month, send the email again, because sometimes they fall through the cracks. But you can become a member, jointhemajorityreport.com. You also can sign up for the AM Quickie, which is a, 5 to 8 minute news brief every day. Should be available to you by 9 a.m. You can find it on our app, or you can find it in any of your podcast receptacles or providers or whatever it is, amquickie.com to sign up. Totally free. Enjoy it. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. We got merch now. I meant to wear a hat today, but I didn't. My daughter took the sweatshirt. The hoodies are so comfortable. I want to break it out too. I want to do like a lightweight hoodie, a heavy hoodie. Oh, really loving the merch. And now, you can check that out at shop.majorityreportradio.com. Don't forget, check out TMBS this week. Find it at patreon.com/TMBS and YouTube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. He's got Chomsky coming up in the next week or so. So make sure you check that out. Also, Nomiki's show. You can find the Nomiki show on patreon.com/Nomiki show and also on youtube.com, The Nomiki Show. And of course, the Antifada. Jamie.
Hello.
What have you guys been up to?
So much, Sam. In between attending,
did you move your backdrop?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I take my laptop in my room. I put it back. Maybe it's at a different angle. You look all right?
Yeah, it looks great.
All right, excellent. So in between attending all of these protests and protests plus, as I call them, we've been recording a lot of content. So this week on the Antifada, we had our 100th episode, which is actually probably closer to 200 because we don't number the bonuses, but that was pretty exciting. So, and it was a very fortuitous time in world history to be having our 100th episode, considering
Indeed.
Our motto is unrest is best. So we talked about the unrest. Yeah, you like that, don't you?
I do like that.
We talked about the widespread unrest and what it means in this country and kind of the pivotal moment in which we find ourselves. That's in the episode that came out Wednesday. And then today we put out a bonus episode that is actually a free bonus for everyone to listen to. Usually the bonuses are for patrons. And we took some questions from the listeners, and folks had a lot of questions about police abolition, as well as how we envision life after capitalism and what went on at the crazy parties that I used to throw. So check that out, patreon.com/theantifada.
Yeah, I regret not going to those parties.
Well, maybe once we get communism, I can go back to focusing on other things like music, nightlife, and throwing really cool parties.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will hold you to that. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Yeah, twitch.tv/literary hangover. Go follow there. I'm going to be playing Assassin's Creed Rogue while listening to the very first sea tale in American novel history, The Pilot by James Fenimore Cooper. So check that out, folks.
We're not going to take any calls today because I just don't want to, like, I feel bad having people hold on, but I will take IMs. So you can get on the app. You can get the app at majorityapp.com. Get on there and IM us, and we will read IMs. Oh, good. Brendan just told me that somebody clipped my F. Michael Tracy sound drop. Well, that's good. I apologize for swearing on the
show. It's going to be real hard for me not to swear now that you've broken the seal, Sam. I'm just warning you.
I didn't mean to do that. I just, it was in the moment. I was just like that. Like,
no, I respect it. Oh, I'm pro swearing. I think people should swear when obscene things are happening.
Wasn't it Ben that said it?
I don't know.
No, you definitely said it.
Oh, I'm just going by what Brendan said. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.